President Price, other platform dignitaries, friends of the seminary, and above all, members of the class of 1983, whom we send forth this day as heralds of the gospel and defenders of the faith. I count this a high privilege. Really, you honor me far beyond my deserts, standing as I do at this high moment, pavilioned in splendor and girded with praise, to march down that aisle to the trumpet's lofty sound in that splendid procession, and then to be seated up here amid these purple mountain majesties above the muted plain. That is no small thing. But now, what shall I do with this challenge? I can, with the blend of Polonius and the JCs, strike the pose of the genial uncle and point the graduates down the road to service and success. Or in the time-worn manner of elder statesmen at commencement rituals down the years, I can wax innocently pompous and declare to your unstartled ears that commencements are only beginnings, or that, as the tattered old aphorism has it, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. But no, in these moments of celebration and dedication, I shall not be content to be amiably avuncular. I shall, if you will indulge me, speak directly to the graduates and in relentless earnest, for I summon them to battle. Like so many of my colleagues in higher education, I long ago came to feel a heavy obligation to remind the young that not all of life is like this bright moment, that in fact, much of it is not. Some of it is harshly annoying, as when one bites into a pebble in a custard. Some of it is starkly cruel. More of it is dreadfully daily, and a great deal of it, unless one loses himself in some transcendent loyalty, is a sort of nothing, the self-canceling vacillations that accumulate at last into a quiet desperation that either settles into itself or seeks escape into vapid amusements or the incontinent indulgence of appetite. Life is not easy. I would not have you think otherwise. Meanwhile, as the years slide by, those whom we love are taken from us one by one, sometimes even without our knowledge or because we have not sleeplessly avoided even the appearance of evil. We bring unbearable pain to those we love most, and we alienate those whom we try hardest to help. All too often, God's purposes surpass our understanding and provoke us to despair or rebellion until we learn to bless the liberating captivity of His will. We spend ourselves in noble causes and in pathetically hopeless ones because we know they are right, only to be defeated, abused, taunted, and sometimes deeply hurt. And we take what melancholy comfort we can as we strain to the breach the faith that these rebuffs are our wound stripes, our secret certificates of distinguished, if humble, service to the King of Kings who has made us His ambassadors. And my young friends, I must tell you, it all goes by so fast. A wisp of fog betwixt us and the sun, one of our poets has said of our lives, an hour of fears, a call to battle and the battle done, a rose choked in the grass, a burst of music down an unlistening street. How truly it is written in the book that is our lamp and our guide, our days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, and we spend our years as a tale that is told. And at the last, how many of the children of men come to find that they have scarcely lived at all? And it is not only in personal crisis and in our secret griefs that we are stretched upon the rack of circumstance. For as another poet, John Donne, a parish pastor, by the way, said so long ago, we are all of us involved in mankind. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. The nations, crouching behind their stockpiles of armaments, taunt each other in precarious equipoise, a balance of terror, and in our own distracted land, once the happy young republic, whom all the rest of the world envied, our sunlit youth has given place to careworn middle age. And when we waken from fitful slumber in the silent midnight watches, We are haunted by fears that we may have squandered both our material and our spiritual patrimony. Our pecuniary values dwindle, moth and rust corrupt our treasure, thieves break through and steal, willing hands our idol, our soil is poisoned, our air polluted, our water befouled, the sense of fair value has atrophied, the instinct of workmanship gone slack, our purposes are trivialized, our humor sickened, our morality compromised, our spirits dejected, our once glorious English language debased, and most of all, alarming of all, the faith of our fathers is under desperate siege. And yet, indeed, therefore, what a rousing challenge you have before you, seminary class of 1983. Let us never hear that any one of you is bored. We look to you for prodigies of healing and reinvigoration to rescue our splendid heritage from the encircling gloom and to restore us once more to the sunny uplands. We look to you to play a central role in the struggle to give America a new birth of freedom, a new birth of justice, a new affirmation of the love of beauty and virtue and truth, a rededication to the faith once for all delivered unto us, and to that righteousness that exalteth a nation under God, all of whose ways are righteous and good altogether, and a thousand ages in whose sight are but a single day. What a commander it is under whom you will be enlisted. He looketh upon the earth and it trembles. He touches the hills and they smoke. I suggest that every civilization has a style and ethos of its own, and what gives it its peculiar qualities and its coherence is the fact that it is grounded upon a shared tradition, which expresses itself especially in a people's values, the received collective judgments and feelings rooted especially in its religious traditions about what is true and false, good and evil, important and trivial, eternal and transient, just and unjust, noble and mean. Indeed, I submit that the central theme of a society's history is the efforts of its great men and women to find form for these values. They are a nation's real heroes, its creative spirits, whether renowned or obscure, who lead the rest of us in finding expression for the values we cherish. Statesman, artist, poet, educator, jurist, theologian, parish priest, editor, scientist, or simply the well-educated and cultivated man and woman. These are the makers, the movers and shakers, and defenders and preservers of a culture who perform for the larger community the crucial task of refining its values and calling their countrymen to this overarching allegiance. Next to a society's values are its institutions, its organized ways of transacting the business of daily living, the crystallized customs which keep a society on its track, preserve order and stability, keep it on course, impose a check upon self-will and reckless innovation, and provide regular, systematic channels of action. One thinks of such institutions as our religion, especially our religion, and our fundamental law, our economic structures and procedures and rules, and of those hundreds of other institutions, large and small, even those little courtesies by which the traffic of human life is eased. These countless institutional arrangements, too, like our values, give distinctiveness to our culture and define its agenda, for their ultimate function is to enable us to realize, that is, to make real, the values and loyalties we profess. And these institutional forms and usages are also under the solicitous and critical scrutiny of a society's educated and cultivated men and women like yourselves, most particularly those who sleeplessly seek out God's purposes for his creation and his creatures. And then, giving a society its bent and texture and its deepest purposes, there is its corpus of beliefs, its credo, the verities it believes and believes in short, its ideas, what we think and say about what we do and feel. These are the ways we put into words and creeds and into other systematic formulations our vindications, our reasons for our loyalties. They define, delimit, verify, and legitimate our values in our institutions. Again, we in the seminaries and in the colleges and universities share with all our literate and thoughtful countrymen a special duty to preserve and refine and keep under steady criticism this complex set of ideals and beliefs which point us to the answers for the great questions of good and evil, of life and death, of time and eternity. Perhaps nothing is more fascinating to students of the rise and fall of civilizations and of our grandest institutions than the circumstance that, as Winston Churchill said, so many owe so much to so few. I sometimes think that there is not a human enterprise, not a program, large or small, not an organization or undertaking of any sort, not even a church, of which this cannot be said, that so many owe so much to so few. Almost always, it is a small, sober, consecrated minority that keeps things afloat. Things survive, they succeed, because a small, dedicated remnant stands guard. One thinks of God's willingness to spare even Sodom and Gomorrah for the sake of a tiny, faithful few. Providence, it would seem, has elected to entrust the better aspirations of a people to a sort of saving remnant who, while their fellows sleep or carouse or pursue their petty purposes, keep anxious vigil on the walls, alert, ready when danger impends, to sound the trumpet and to summon the brave. And of course, I'm not speaking here of the Pentagon sentries on the ramparts they watch. I speak of the heroes of the spirit and the mind, the heroes of the faith, the saints and seers, prophets and poets, scholars and artists, the guardians of the sacred traditions to whose keeping a people's well-being is so largely confided. They are the first line of defense, who keep the credo, the whole public corpus of belief, under steady surveillance and constructive criticism, progressively refining and clarifying and restating and adapting to changing external challenges the unchanging beliefs and ideals, the unchanging sacred word. Can anyone longer doubt that our most dangerous foes are often in our own household, corrupting the spirit and setting at naught the counsels of our wisest and best? And are not the corruptors more powerfully armed than ever in the history of human susceptibility? They have in their arsenal dreadfully effective engines of persuasion, reinforced by the anesthetic soothings of puerile amusements, multiplying creature comforts, and seductive distractions that beguile the hearts and minds of deluded and infatuated millions whose intellectual and moral defenselessness renders them easy prey. Even in individual congregations, the purity of the word and the sacraments are often under the anxious scrutiny of only a few, much as the bulk of its whole program and its budget are often underwritten by a small minority. And so it is also with nations, indeed with world cultures and whole civilizations, where again a consecrated core of watchers and defenders keep vigil. And I must tell you, young people, that the educated and educating community, both in church and state, the educated and educating community that you are now entering, finds it increasingly difficult to arouse their fellow citizens to their peril. The forces ranged against us have not only power on their side and numbers and the world's wealth and honors and seductive appeals, all the more devastating because these seductions coincide so nearly with humankind's baser nature. They have besides the listless acquiescence of those whom they delude. They who need you most will often regard you as an officious meddler, at worst as the enemy himself, and they will regularly defeat you at the polls, and in town councils, and in conventions, and even in congregational meetings. I reverently believe that this defines precisely a principal role for our beloved synod in America and in Christendom today. All of Christendom is imperiled when we relax our sturdy confessionalism and barter it away for a bland ecumenism or an amiable dialogue, which, as each of the parties magnanimously gives up something, only leaves all of them poorer without anything adding anything to the common store. All of Christendom suffers when we moderate our proclamation of the scriptures in all their purity and power. Let us face squarely the awesome, the almost terrifying truth. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is one of the last great confessional churches on earth. And as we all know to our pain, even Lutheranism is losing its confessional identity in some quarters, so much so that thousands, I venture to say millions, of nominal Lutherans around the world scarcely know what a confessional church is. There also, as in all other major aspects of our contemporary culture, our whole glorious heritage, both religious and secular, is under withering attack. Indeed, the very principle of heritage itself is in mortal jeopardy. This revolt in our time invokes, in its shabby defense, the plausible slogans of human dignity, or the free individual doing his thing. Against the transcendent in religion, against ancient and tested values in education, against cherished political and constitutional precepts and practice, against the venerable rules that have kept social relations and private and public morality in a reasonably stable frame since our culture's infancy. I would be the last to dispute that the shared tradition upon which our American culture rests is flawed and in desperate need of amendment, that an undisciplined technology and a misapplied and perverted science have brought us to the age of the all but wholly secularized, dehumanized, depersonalized, and pitifully diminished man. But shall we find the remedy in cynicism and the rejection of meaning, in a universe without design, in instant gratifications that turn to ashes in our mouth and to destruction that wasteth at noonday, in the upraised clenched fist and the downcast clenched mind, in their arrogant disdain for the past and for the stored wisdom of the ages, in their angry repudiation of the splendid, if flawed, tradition in which American civilization was cradled, in their shrill demand for relevance, which they confuse with mere contemporaneity, in their substitution of a situation ethic like tennis without a net for the ineffable and the transcendent. They have mounted a new barbarian invasion, which, if it is not hurled back, can end only with the toppling of our whole culture from its historic base, cutting it off from the soil in which it germinated and from the life-giving elements that have sustained it for centuries. This steady erosion of heritage, this calamitous repudiation, seems now to have come full circle. It has come to the rejection of theology and purity of doctrine as if they were some kind of iron Madonna from whose suffocating Gothic embrace we need to be rescued. And with this has emerged a spurning of all that is transcendental and normative and regulatory in religion, in law, in education, in ethics, in private and public conduct, and even in art. Some have likened this revolt against our cultural heritage, this cutting ourselves adrift from our historic moorings, and especially from the great affirmations of Christian orthodoxy, as they were grounded upon the Bible and our carefully articulated confessions, I say some have likened this tragic alienation to the plight of a cut flower in a vase. The flower is to all appearances still sweet and fresh, for it contains yet a portion of the stored nutriments it had drawn through its roots before it was alienated from what in the days of its health it had fed upon, but the residuum is quickly consumed and the blossom is fatally ravaged. I prefer an even more doleful metaphor from the plant world, the girdling of a tree. The advancing American pioneer, you will remember, struggling to subdue the forest, often chose to avoid the back-breaking toil of felling the tough green trees with his axe by girdling the trees and then burning off the standing dead timber. He had only to cut an inch-deep incision around the trunk close to the earth, for it is immediately under the bark that the stored food flows upward in the tree, and the moment that cut was made, the tree was doomed beyond recall. For the intricate mechanism by which the lofty oak manufactured and distributed its nourishment through all its vast anatomy had been forever interrupted, no matter if 200 or 300 years had gone into its maturing. After the girdling, life went on, to be sure, for a season, and the tree apparently lost little of its outward vigor, for the food had earlier been stored in sufficient quantity to complete the year's cycle of life and growth. And in November, the leaves drifted to the ground, and the lofty monarch of the forest faced confidently into the winter, apparently to be revived when the buds should swell once more in the spring. But all is not well with that tree. The hand of man has shut off the fountain which God had quickened. And when the spring rains come, and the sun warms the earth, and the elements under the forest floor offer themselves again to the roots that seek them out, this tree will not respond to the ancient impulses that animated it in the past. It has been forever separated from the nourishment that first warmed it into life so long ago, and then sustained it through its youth and on into the days of its greatness. And of course, we Missouri Synod Lutherans know that the most devastating element in that catastrophic repudiation of heritage is the disastrous erosion of the faith of our fathers in favor of a bland, secular, man-centered, pseudo-religion of salvation by character, and the amelioration of the human condition solely in the here and now, with its seductive promise of social redemption in a world without poverty and conflict. Based as it is on the rock of Christ and the Word of God, how awesome is the responsibility and the opportunity and the challenge that our church faces to hold back the assault upon pure Christian confessionalism, the revolt against the age-old truths of God's Word and against the offer of the gospel. It demands of us our utmost commitment to preserve our heritage. And with it, incidentally, we will also be helping to revive the social and ethical and intellectual and aesthetic heritage that these religious roots have so long nourished. For there is no mistaking that we are now among the last defenders of the stout-hearted theological literacy, this forthright confessionalism, which not only lighted the way to the reconciliation of individual sinners with God for eternity, and which also in times past illumined the daily life of man in his pilgrimage in time. That, I maintain, is your challenge and your opportunity, and no less your duty. For if there is none to sound the trumpet, who will go into the battle?